Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to only on LA Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, we are going to introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from today's subject. This is one powerful way that we together can make a positive difference. Now, our topic today is going to be on mental health. And I think right now, anybody that is not living under a rock knows that there's a lot of things going on that have been changing out there. Nearly everyone who has sought help with their mental health has at least considered the concept of a therapist. And a good amount of people in the United States have standing appointments with mental health professionals, which has increased during these unprecedented times. These professionals have focused methods that they study, and clients who book or are referred to these professionals with these specialized methods. Enter our guest today, Dr. Richard Lane, and his Neuroscience of Enduring Change. Dr. Lane is a clinical psychiatrist and psychotherapist trained in cognitive neuroscience and emotional research, focusing on the brain mechanisms of emotion, emotional awareness, and emotion regulation. His background in cognitive and affective neuroscience is now being integrated with his ongoing experience as a therapist and psychotherapy educator. Dr. Lane, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's very good to have you with us. If you could speak up just a little bit, because I can barely hear you.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Oh, there we go.
Is that okay?
Yeah, oh. Much, much better.
Okay.
So I have enjoyed reading the book that you have contributed to. But it's much more like a manual, you know, in the sense that, you know, I think it really goes a lot into really educating people in psychotherapy and in neuroscience. So share a little bit about you and what brought you to this particular approach to psychotherapy.
Right. Well, I've been interested in psychotherapy from a very early age. My father was a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, so I kind of grew up, you know, learning about that way of thinking. I got trained as a doctor and a psychiatrist and became fascinated with research on how emotions influence our health, mm-hmm. and how the brain works and how the brain and body interact. And for many years, that was the focus of my research. While at the same time, I was a full-time faculty member at a medical school and training people how to do psychotherapy and how to do psychiatry. And then about 15 years ago or so, I started really thinking about how to take advantage of what I was understanding about the brain and applying mm-hmm. it to psychotherapy. You know, there are over 500 different types of psychotherapy. And, you know, there's a real desire within the field to kind of hone in on what are the fundamentals and how does it really work and how can you do the work so that it leads to lasting change? And so I was interested in that just in general for the field, but also the psychiatry residents who are training in psychotherapy were really looking for answers, you know, to address how do we understand how these different psychotherapies work. And so that was the basis for a major theoretical article that we wrote in 2015 in a leading neuroscience journal, where we capitalized on new understanding about memory, which is that memory is not a fixed thing. Memory can be updated and transformed. And what this is all about is how to take advantage of that fact to optimize therapeutic benefits. And emotion and memory have very important interactions. The things that we remember the best are highly emotionally charged. And in psychotherapy, there's a lot that goes on involving emotional exchange with the therapist. And so we're really trying to, you know, talk about how we can reactivate old memories and update them with new emotional experiences to get the most bang for the buck.
Now, when you're talking about memory and you're talking about some of the changes, what changes in psychotherapy can be directly attributed to reconsolidation? Yes, reconsolidation. Yeah.
So one of the things that I've learned about memory, I think is very fundamental to this, is that memory, we think of it as having a record of the past, right? Mm-hmm. We record what happened. But, you know, why do we do that? It's because we need it as a guide to the future, okay? And so whenever we enter a new situation, we automatically bring up old memories that orient us to predict what's going to happen in this situation, right? So old memories are living things in a sense, and they're not just the past. And so what we're really doing is we are working with memory to help people not only recall the past, but also update the emotional component of those memories. And we think that that really will have an influence on how people perceive situations and respond to situations in the future.
Now, can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Right. So for example, if something happened in the past, maybe in your childhood, that you were very ashamed about, okay, mm-hmm. and maybe you never spoke to anyone about it before, okay, and it kind of haunts you and it influences how you interact with other people. If you were to bring that up with a psychotherapist, once you establish an alliance with that person and you trust them, and lo and behold, the therapist responds to you in a way that's unexpected. It's very compassionate, it's non-judgmental, it is, you know, forgiving and maybe even loving. That changes the emotional component of that memory. You start to feel differently about what happened. You start to feel differently about yourself. And it's not going to affect you in the same way going forward in social situations. You might be more inclined to think that people will be accepting of you rather than rejecting of you. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes. But what I'm thinking is that... So, in fact, I sat in on what was called forum or group, and I was really shocked. And it was a group of teenage girls, and so there was a facilitator. I was sitting in as a guest, and there were 16 girls. And the subject, one of the girls started talking about being sexually exploited, and all of a sudden, other girls started to talk about it as well. And before we were done, 15 of the 16 girls had been traumatized based on some sort of inappropriate sexual touching or something. Mm-hmm. So if we use that in this situation, this is a memory that I know that in typical psychotherapy or whatever, a lot of it is bringing this memory out. In some cases, it's suppressed. In some cases, it's not. But with a subject like this, how do you change that memory to the point in which it's no longer affecting them, let's say, every time they're around a certain type of person, because it reminds them of that event that occurred when they were very young?
Right.
So tell me how your method not only helps this situation, but how it does it in a much quicker fashion.
Well, so I think that one of the things that happens with trauma is that people become defensive and apprehensive in a more generalized kind of way. So, for example, if you've been sexually abused by one person, you might be reticent to get close to all men, for example.
Right.
Okay. And I think that the goal of the therapy is to recontextualize it, essentially, so that the fear is associated with a specific stimulus and doesn't overgeneralize, right?
Mm-hmm.
The steps that we think are involved are, number one, to recall the old memory and the old painful feeling, okay? That's a very hard thing to do, actually. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, establishing a therapeutic alliance and establishing trust with the therapist or with the group is really essential. And then what you've accomplished by doing that is that you've reactivated the old memory in such a way that it can potentially be modified or transformed. We call it in a labile state.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it's in that state, then to have what we'd call a corrective emotional experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, for example, women who've been sexually, you know, abused might feel guilty, might feel like they were at fault. And I think that by bringing in an objective perspective, you can help the person see, no, that's absolutely not the case. And, you know, it's not your fault. And this person, you know, had no business doing that whatsoever. It's really horrible what happened to you. And, you know, I'm so sorry that happened to you. When this has been locked away, you know, it just kind of festers and, you know, the person is just generally protective. But I think going into it in this particular way and define exactly what the problem was and then learn to discriminate between what's safe and what's not. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't happen all at once. But I think it's, you know, I think we have a handle on how to do it as efficiently as possible.
And so if you're changing this memory and you now have 10, 15, 20 years later, how might that memory appear, or is it being dissolved?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what would would you say that it's being altered to where it now just appears in their mind in a different way so that it has different triggers, or it's dissolved to where they're not triggered to go to it at all.
Yeah. So there's an important concept here, which is that we think that when, as people grow up, they create what we'd call an internal working model of how the social world works.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to update that model and modify it for the better, okay? So I had mentioned the first two steps, activate the old memory and the old painful feeling. And the second step is to have a corrective emotional experience,
mm-hmm.
one or more. But then the third step is to practice new ways of construing the world and responding in a variety of different contexts so that it generalizes, okay? And so I think let me just clarify that the memory itself doesn't dissolve. The memory is transformed. In particular, we think the emotional component of the memory and the action consequences of the emotional component. And then the idea is that the more you practice it, the more natural it becomes. Certainly this kind of psychotherapy helps people to realize what's going on and to make different kinds of decisions. And the goal is to do that enough so that life becomes pretty normal again.
Right. So that it's not being triggered because you've sort of gone over it so many times in a different context. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't bring out the same negative reaction.
Right.
Okay.
So for example, you might be in a situation where you might be triggered and you might be very afraid, but then because of therapy, you've learned to be compassionate towards yourself, to be, you know, caring toward yourself, to be supportive, and to feel stronger and better able to handle the situation. And so those kinds of things will lead you to approach the situations differently.
So, and while we're talking about memory, what's the difference between episodic and schematic memory, and how do they interact or contribute to our sense of self?
Right. Those are terrific questions. So one of the reasons why we wrote our theoretical article, investigators here at the University of Arizona, Lee Ryan and Lynn Nadel and others, have really shown that there's more of a connection between episodic and semantic memory than we previously realized. So episodic memory is the memory for a specific event. Mm-hmm. Semantic memory is generalized knowledge. Okay. And that's a kind of distillation of individual experiences. We use the example of, you know, a young child seeing a little creature on the ground flying in the air and sees one, sees another. And over time, it recognizes that there's some commonalities. You know, one may be yellow, one may be red, one may be blue. But the concept distills out of a bird. Okay, that's semantic note. Mm-hmm. That's generalized knowledge. That is a distillation of specific episodic memories, right? Now, schematic memory is a kind of semantic knowledge. It's generalized knowledge, but it has to do with kind of sequences of what transpires in situations. Okay? And we think that that is really especially important for the kind of issues we're talking about, because I use the idea of the internal working model, right, of the social world. That is a kind of collection of schematic memories. Okay, and so how does it relate to the self? Well, I think that the core of the self really is our emotions. So these schemas are basically influencing how we perceive the situation and how we respond, and that is directly related to our sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a question coming in, and again, mm-hmm, I want to thank those people that take the time to send in questions, either to call in, to instant message, email, however you do it. We really appreciate the fact that you take the time to send these questions in. This one reads, my cousin has had serious bipolar issues all of her life. When she is on her medication, she is able to cope, but she hates how it makes her unable to function normally. The result is that periodically she stops taking it only to slowly inch back into her depression and anxiety. What is your opinion about this condition, and is there any hope for enduring change for this condition? And this is from Alice in New York.
Well, it's a great question. Manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder is a very serious condition associated with high suicide rates, et cetera. It's the most genetically loaded or determined psychiatric condition that we have. And it is, what she's describing is not at all uncommon. That that, you know, when you take medications, it can help stabilize mood and help stabilize behavior so that people are not as at much risk, but they don't feel as good, right? Mm-hmm. So that is a question of kind of optimizing the medication management. And, you know, I think fortunately we have a number of different medications that can be tried that are mood stabilizers. With regard to enduring change, I just want to clarify that when we're talking about enduring change, we're talking about the psychotherapy component, right, of treatment. The medications are very, very important in helping to stabilize symptoms and reduce symptoms. But then it comes back to that old internal working model that people have. What's the nature of the relationships that people have, right? And that needs to be worked on in psychotherapy. Medication alone is not going to address that problem of recurrent maladaptive patterns in relationships.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the neuroscience of enduring change. One of the things that I was really interested in when I was reading it is that this seems to be a method that gets to the heart of things very quickly and focuses on a specific area and, you know, for lack of better terms, clearing that. Mm-hmm. Share a little bit about the differences of what you're doing now with the neuroscience of enduring change and how that differs from maybe more traditional psychotherapy where people can be in psychotherapy for years.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could say that we found the answer so that long-term psychotherapy isn't needed. I think that I think what we're claiming is that there are a variety of different ways of doing psychotherapy work through this mechanism. But I think that severity and pervasiveness of the problem will influence how long the psychotherapy needs to go on for. Okay, so if for example, the problem is one that's confined to certain specific situations, or if it's a temporary change in mood, you know, that might last weeks or months, that is reversible. Those are two examples of maybe things that could be treated more quickly. Whereas if the problem is one that goes across different situations, right, and has been going on for a long time, then longer term therapy on the range of a year or two may be needed. Now, I think that one of the things that I would really highlight in our model compared to traditional psychotherapy, where traditional psychotherapy had a major focus on helping people to understand themselves mm-hmm. and understand their path. And I think that we now realize that understanding or insight is not enough to bring about change. Okay, you also have to have new experiences, new corrective emotional experiences. And so I think that that is really the key ingredient in bringing in active emotional arousal. You have to go through the pain. You have to arrive before you can leave. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I think the recognition of that really facilitates getting into it sooner rather than later. And so I think that's the antidote to endless therapy where you're just talking about whatever comes to mind, but there isn't a real active attempt to correct what's wrong.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like you to discuss maybe obviously without using any names or anything, but, you know, an example of a situation to where someone maybe was in therapy for a very, very long time and using your method allowed this person to quickly deal with a particular issue and move through it very quickly. So if we can do that, but for, again, when we come back, but right now we're going to take a break. So for everybody out there, stay with us. You're listening to Answers.
Needs of families in crisis. West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585. That's 1-800-899-8585. Or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network. We are talking with Dr. Richard Lane. We're talking about his neuroscience of enduring change. And before we went to break, so I asked a question in regards to sort of to be able to go into a case study, so to speak, and maybe something that is relatively common so that, you know, there may be somebody out there listening that's going to go, oh, that's what I'm going through. And especially now today with a lot of people going through, there's a lot of depression. There's a lot of people feeling isolated because of the pandemic situation and the way it's being handled. So what are some things that, or a case study that would allow people to see how they might be able to get through it quicker? And also, what are some things that people can do at home that they can do themselves to maybe help get them through what is a difficult time?
Wow. Okay, well, I did think of a case that I think would be useful. Want to give credit to, major credit and acknowledgement to Dr. Bruce Ecker from York, who is really the first psychotherapist to write about the importance of memory reconsolidation as it relates to psychotherapy. So I think he published his first book in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. And he has a number of, you know, case vignettes that I think are very, very powerful. And Dr. Ecker has a chapter in our book as well. But he gives the example of a man who was in his 50s who came to him because he was unhappy with basically the fact that he hadn't really succeeded occupationally in the way that he wanted to. He'd work in a job for a couple of years, kind of get tired of it, move on to something else. And he kept changing every 2 or 3 years. And here he was in his 50s and he didn't really have much to show for it. And so Dr. Ecker took a careful history, including, you know, learning about his childhood, and found out that this man's father worked in a factory, and he hated his work, but he got a decent wage, and he made enough money to support his family, and he just stuck it out, you know, for decades. But many times he'd come home and he would, you know, tell the family, never stay in a job, you know, on a long-term basis. It, you know, it'll ruin your life. Okay. So this detail came out in the history taking, and, you know, this client had never really made the connection between this message that he'd gotten. It was kind of an implicit memory. It was a memory that was deeply stored in his mind, but wasn't in the forefront, but it was influencing his behavior. Okay. So Dr. Ecker worked with him to you know, reactivate that old memory and the old feelings, and then to really look at, you know, the whether that really made sense for him. he was able to get in touch with all of the negative emotional consequences associated with changing jobs. And with Dr. Ucker's help, he started looking for examples of job for a longer period of time and had actually been quite fulfilled. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so to actually bring that to mind, to experience that, and to juxtapose that with the old memory that was causing the problem, created the transformation such that he was freed up and he was able to feel okay about choosing something and sticking with it. And then there was some long-term follow-up, and indeed it was successful. So that gives you a kind of in a nutshell how an old memory can, which has a lot of emotional significance,
right,
can really influence a person's life without their realizing it. And it can be transformed. That's the idea.
I like it. Now, I know you mentioned in your book that REM sleep is very important. So share with us what the role of REM sleep is in transformation.
Yeah. So so one of the things that is fascinating about this whole area of bringing brain science into psychotherapy is that it opens up new ways of thinking about clinical issues and brings a new perspective to it. So if you're depressed or if you're anxious, that goes with having trouble sleeping. And we know that as clinicians, we always want to help people to sleep better, right? That's really a major target symptom. But what we haven't really realized is that that may, the ability to sleep well may influence how successful psychotherapy will be. And here's why. The science of memory tells us that, you know, the memories get reactivated and new information is introduced, but they get revised or reconsolidated at night when you're sleeping. Okay. And if you think about it, that makes sense because we're essentially, you know, taking in all sorts of new information during the day. But when we're sleeping, the outside world is shut out, and then we can do some housekeeping and we can do some storage and things can get, you know, consolidated in that way. REM sleep is very interesting. You know, that's when most of dreaming happens, right? Mm-hmm. And what's been determined is that emotional memories get reconsolidated preferentially during REM sleep. Okay.
Okay.
So it's very important then that people be able to sleep well and have good REM cycles in order to consolidate the changes that would happen in psychotherapy. Okay. So there are certain kinds of medications that actually may help with anxiety or depression, but actually can interfere with REM sleep. Serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac and others being an example of that, okay?
Wait, hold on. You said one of them would be a serotonin inhibitor?
Serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why, if somebody's depressed, you would want to inhibit serotonin when the probability is they're probably not making enough.
Right. You're inhibiting the reuptake so that more is available gotcha. In the synaptic cleft.
Gotcha. Okay.
But the point is that you may need, and I'm not telling people to change their medications without talking to their doctor. Okay.
Gotcha.
But an implication here is that, you know, we work in treatment in phases. And the first phase is, you know, oftentimes start medication, get symptoms under control. And then once you're in a more stable state, then look at predisposing factors that may be contributing to the possibility of relapse, okay, in that more second psychotherapy phase. And that's where the medications that you're on could interfere with progress in reconsolidating memories in psychotherapy. And so, you know, one of the things we try to do is have people stay on medication for as long as they need them, but then taper off when they don't need them anymore.
Good.
And if they still need help with sleep, there are very many non-pharmacological ways of helping people to sleep, such as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, various kinds of sleep hygiene activities and things like that. So it's an example of an implication that comes out of the science of memory that has potential clinical application.
All right. Now, for those that, you know, we've used a lot of different types of therapy in this conversation, and there may be some people that may not know the differences. So share a little bit about psychodynamic therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and regular behavioral therapy, and talk a little bit about what the differences are and how does someone know which is best for them based on what they're going through.
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. And I, to be honest, we haven't really figured that out. But I can tell you what the different kinds of therapy are. Mm-hmm. So one kind of therapy called behavioral therapy or exposure therapy. So, for example, if you're scared of heights, let's say you're scared of spiders, for example, the treatment might involve gradually exposing you to tiny doses of a spider. It might be a kind of rubber spider first, right. But then, we introduce a live spider and you bring it closer and closer, not beyond what you can tolerate, but you learn that the spider is not as dangerous as you thought. Okay, mm-hmm. That applies to other things like fear of heights. It applies to things like, social phobia, where you're afraid of, being rejected by other people. And so you have gradual exposures to the feared situation, and you learn that it's not so frightening and that you find that you can work with it. Okay. So, interestingly, that kind of therapy doesn't involve memory reconsolidation, but it involves what we think of as a new memory. It's called extinction, and it's like you recognize that, the situation, these exposure therapies can very much help people, and they can lead to relief. But the issue is, does it change the original memory, or is the original memory still there? If it's still there, it can lead to relapse. Okay? And so it's still beneficial to do it, but cognitive behavioral therapy is a further elaboration of that, where it's often used in the context of depression and anxiety disorders and a variety of other conditions, insomnia, et cetera. And it really has to do with fundamentally recognizing that, for example, people get depressed because of the internal dialogue, the automatic thoughts, the things that they say to themselves. They're highly critical of themselves. They're very judgmental. And if you can, work with a therapist to identify what those cognitions are, right? You can undermine them. You can change them. You can, is it really true that you're a stupid person? You're not. And so how can you change your behavior as a result of this new way of thinking? And then you're given homework and you practice. And there's a very good scientific evidence base supporting cognitive behavioral therapy. Psychodynamic psychotherapy is the oldest one. And I think that it's a type of psychotherapy that's continued to evolve. I think that there is an indication for that when people have problems that transcend different situations and that are enduring trait characteristics of the person. And that kind of therapy may go on for a year or two or three. But the whole, from our perspective, the whole memory reconsolidation concept would apply. It not only involves having, in psychodynamic psychotherapy, not only going through past experiences with other people, important people in your family, other relationships, but also uniquely in psychodynamic psychotherapy, you form a special relationship with the psychotherapist such that you start having feelings for the therapist, and the problems that you have in your other relationships get manifested and expressed in the interaction with the psychotherapist, and having the experience of working through the problem in the room with the therapist, the same kind of fundamental problem that you may be having with a spouse or with a sibling. That is very, very powerful, and we think leads to enduring change and works by a memory reconsolidation mechanism.
Yep, we have another question that's coming in via email. This one reads, I'm actually quite frightened regarding the effects of this continued lockdown will have on our youth and our seniors. Something has shifted and people are more distant and fearful of each other. How do you think this long period of distancing is going to affect everyone moving forward, who I feel really need close social and physical contact to stay emotionally healthy? And this is from Brandy in California.
It's really an excellent question. And there's no question that COVID and all the restrictions associated with it have really taken an enormous toll. fortunately, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel with, you know, vaccination rates, you know, being as high as they are, and there will be a return to normality, hopefully toward the end of the year. I think that, you know, people are really craving, you know, interaction with others. Most people mm-hmm. are. And I think it's just been very, very difficult. It's hard for me to say what the long-term effects will be. My guess would be that people who had, for example, early life trauma, who had abuse or neglect in childhood, may be particularly traumatized by COVID and will have more difficulty recovering and getting back to normal than people who had a healthier upbringing. Okay. And so that would be, if people have trouble getting back into the swing of things, that might be an indication for seeing a psychotherapist. And maybe finding out how some early experiences may be interacting with the current situation to create barriers to normality.
So I just glanced at the clock. We've got about 4 minutes. So if you can give us your recommendations on what you believe the duration, spacing, and number of psychotherapy sessions, and I realize that this is kind of hard because I'm sort of envisioning, you know, I mean, obviously everybody is different, but is there a number that somebody should start to feel like this is a good fit? They're making progress? Is this even a fair question?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's very important. I think that you can tell within a couple of sessions whether or not you feel understood and whether or not you feel that the person is trustworthy.
Okay.
I think that within 3, 4, 5 sessions, there should be a kind of working alliance so that you really have a sense of what the problem is and what you're working on. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that shorter-term therapy is really a desirable goal, something in the 16 to 20 to 24 sessions to really try to get something accomplished in that time period, I think is very often very doable.
Well, and I like that because one of my companies, we did behavioral consulting for families, and my approach was, and I explained to them, I said, you know, if you're utilizing someone like us at that time, I said, if they're not planning to wean themselves off within about 12 to 16 weeks. And it doesn't mean that will have to happen, because you don't know what you're going to get into. But if you're not starting out planning that way, I have a concern. So so I'm right with you in the sense that, you know, I think that part of it is that I don't know that we're doing anybody any good if we're making them dependent upon somebody else. You know, when you have somebody that's been going for 10 years and it's like, you know, maybe now you're just dependent on that person. So we need to be empowering people also, is at least my feeling.
I think that dependency or vulnerability needs to be temporary. And I think it's really important for the therapist to be fostering resilience and independence from the get-go. But very importantly, you have to arrive before you can leave. So you have to kind of bring down the barriers and open up and share to allow yourself to have the kind of corrective experiences that can then send you on your way.
So, and again, and going back to memories, because it's been very intriguing to me, you know, as I was reading your work. And at one point you mentioned memories just being erased. And so the thoughts in my mind and the detective in me is, I'm thinking about, is there a concern of, you know, if we're erasing a memory, is there a concern of the possibility of people placing false memory? You know, I mean, what are some of the issues that you're having to look at or deal with? Because we're touching on, I think, a very delicate situation when we're dealing with people's mind.
That's true. We're not at the point where we can erase memories.
Okay.
That can be done in animal models with drugs, but those drugs aren't safe in people. But I think that what is true is that there are such things as false memories, and some of the same mechanisms that contribute to false memories also contribute to psychotherapy change. Not that it's false, but it really has to do with the malleability and non-permanence of memories. And so what we're trying to do in psychotherapy is taking advantage of that phenomenon to get the best possible outcome.
I appreciate that. Time has flown by. Richard, thank you so much for taking your time. And Is the book available for people to get? And if so, what is the best way for them to get it?
Either directly from Oxford University Press.
Okay. All right. And if anybody would like to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
I have a website at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Arizona.
Okay.
And so there's background information on me, and my email address is lane@email.arizona.edu.
All right. And if you're driving out there and don't try to write that down, we'll make sure that all that information is on our website at answers.network. So, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time, and not just for coming on the show, but for writing the book, because, folks, there is a lot of information in this. And it isn't just Richard. There's a lot of very, very bright and dedicated people that have put information together with a focus on being able to help people lead greater lives.
That's right. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Right. You're very welcome. And now for everybody out there, join us next Monday when our guest will be Columbus Short to discuss his new book, Short Stories, the autobiography of Columbus Short. 15 years ago, he was one of Hollywood's brightest rising stars. Unfortunately, personal issues surrounding drug use kept him from reaching his full potential. In our interview, Columbus is going to share not only details of his journey from childhood to Hollywood, but he's going to explore how even the most checkered of pasts can create a different person with the right amount of will and drive, especially when it comes to fulfilling your true destiny. So you're going to want to check that out. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network, or you can subscribe to our show through iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, if you want to see us, Spreaker, SoundCloud, and many other popular podcast platforms. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and I want you to know we greatly appreciate it. And please, not just our show, but any show that you believe that is providing positive information, share it with other people. Get the word out. This is the only way that we're really going to be able to combat the negativity that's being put out in lots of other areas, is to be able to let people know that there are positive shows out there. There are shows that are going to make people think and make people feel better about their lives and hopefully make decisions to help others as well. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.